Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, Out of This World, we take a look at one of the world's oldest astronomical observatories right here in the Vatican. And it offers a summer school for young astronomers that takes them on a unique journey to the stars. And remembering one of Italy's greatest heroes, we talk to the great-granddaughter of Risorgimento revolutionary Giuseppe Garibaldi. Extrasolar planets and brown dwarfs. They're out of this world. Never heard of these terms? Well, neither had I. That is, before I went out to the Pope's summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, home to the Vatican's very own astronomical observatory. That's right. The Vatican has one of the world's oldest astronomical institutes, with roots dating from the mid-16th century. Today, the Jesuit-run observatory is internationally acclaimed and conducts research in cooperation with leading European and American national and university observatories. Offering a breathtaking panorama of the volcanic Lake Albano and its tiny villages, the Vatican Observatory offers a month-long summer school to astronomy students every 2 years. This year, students from 22 nations attended courses. Guess what they were studying?
The topic for this summer school is two related ideas. One are planets around other stars, which have only been discovered in the last 12 years. And the other are brown dwarfs, which are objects that are bigger than a planet, but smaller than a real star. And so they're related to planets, and likewise they've only been discovered in the last 12 years.
Jesuit astronomer Father Guy Consolomagno told me more about brown dwarfs and extrasolar planets.
We've now discovered hundreds of both, and we're beginning to be able to sort them out, classify them, understand how they work, wonder why you see certain varieties of one kind but you don't see a different kind, and try to come up with theories that can explain how they were made, how they evolve, how that fits into the whole realm of ideas and objects from Earth-sized up to giant stars and galaxies.
And you do these programs every 2 years, and each time you do it, you have a different theme?
Every time we have a different topic. The one 2 years ago was on astrobiology, so we were looking at life on some of these other planets. 10 years ago, we did it on comets and asteroids. We've done a number on galaxies and the way you classify galaxies, the way galaxies evolve. We had one on cosmology and the Big Bang Theory and all the other bits of science that go into how the universe was formed. So it matches the interests of the astronomers at the observatory itself, which ranges all across these boundaries.
And there seem to be no boundaries to limit students at the Vatican Observatory Summer School. Some of them spoke to me as they lunched on the school's spectacular Lakeview Terrace. I asked them why they chose the Vatican's observatory to learn more about the stars.
Sarah, I'm from South Africa. I'm working at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban. And why I decided to come to this program would be, it's a very interesting topic. There have been a lot of papers in the literature recently, and I thought it would be an excellent opportunity to meet with leaders in the field and to meet up with people that we could possibly collaborate with in the future.
I'm one of the faculty. I'm Fernando Cameron. I'm originally from Spain. I'm a former student of the Vatican Summer School, so I was here back in 1990. And when I was proposed to come here and to teach on this subject, I didn't have any hesitation that was an opportunity to take.
Beautiful here too.
Well, it's not just beautiful. I mean, there are many things that you see and that you don't see that make it beautiful indeed. Now I'm working for the last 12 years at the European Southern Observatory near Munich in Germany. The field in which I'm working is related to one of the two subtopics of the school, so in brown dwarfs. So that's what I'm lecturing about.
I'm Nathan. I'm from Canada. I just finished at St. Mary's University.
Qi Zhaoxiang.
And where are you from?
From Shanghai, China.
And how did you hear about this summer program and what made you interested in studying at the Vatican's observatory?
Yeah, I found a paper in my observatory, so I want to make some friends, and I think this is a very important opportunity to improve my spoken English. Also, the latest information about the astronomy.
It just seemed like a really good idea and a lot of fun to come, and so I applied and decided to come meet new people from all sorts of different cultures.
My name is Sarah. I'm from Trinidad. That's in the Caribbean. And at the University of the West Indies, we don't really have an astronomy program, to say, like a major's program. For my undergraduate research, I did work on extrasolar planets. So basically, this school is all the teaching I'm going to get. That's why I was really excited to come and also get an idea of different sort of research that's happening in the world right now.
My name is Jeanette, and I'm from Sweden, but I work as a PhD student since just 3 months ago in Leiden Observatory in the Netherlands.
I'm Sofia, I'm from Mexico, and I wanted to come here because since I'm a chemist, I want to learn all I can about astronomy and all the related knowledge, so I can one day I could devote my life to astrochemistry.
I'm Theo Kent, I'm from Belgium. I came to the Vatican Observatory Summer School because I think it's a great opportunity to learn a lot of things about a very specific subject and get to meet a lot of new people in the meantime, international-wise, so you can have new contacts from all over the world to help you with things in the future.
I'm Ratna from Indonesia. I come here to learn about extrasolar planet, and besides, extrasolar planet is my research topic in my country.
None of you have any connections with the Vatican or with the Church. Why did you decide to come to a Vatican observatory?
In a sense, I think it's interesting to see how the Jesuits work around here with both science and religion. Yeah, it's a difficult combination, I think, and apparently they are able to do this. So I think it's interesting.
Yeah, but I don't think the Vatican label was kind of important. I mean, it was a scientific school, so I think that was the aim. So Vatican, quite important, I think.
I see the topic in the school, not the Vatican.
Though the summer school is now over, the Vatican Observatory is already looking ahead. The observatory's director, Father Jose Funes, says the International Year of Astronomy in 2009 offers a unique opportunity to astronomers the world over to share their findings.
Yes, it's a great time because it's going to be a universal year of astronomy, and different countries are organizing. The Vatican Observatory is a member of the International Astronomical Union. So we have some ideas and projects for that year. For the moment, it's too early to say, but 400 years before, Galileo pointed for the first time a telescope to the sky. And he saw the moons of Jupiter. I tell my students in class that was the first time that a human being pointed a telescope to the sky. Now we are used to know, we see almost daily new pictures from Saturn, other planets, galaxies. We are used to that, but it is something really important for not only the history of astronomy, but the history of humanity. I quote Dante, the Divine Comedy, sometimes when I give public lectures, because I think it's a good image to explain the mission of astronomy in the world. Dante, at the end of the Inferno, the Hell, at the end, he said, "We went out to see the stars. And I think that's the mission of astronomy for humanity, is to put in perspective our lives, how small we are, humanity is small in this little world that is Earth, and how with our wars, so many problems that humanity have created to itself, terrorism, oppression. So I think astronomy can teach us to put our life in perspective. I think we need to take advantage of this International Year of Astronomy to think ourselves like we are part of a universe that is 14 billion years old. Our lives are small, but at the same time, very precious. And it's a good chance that we have to learn more about the beauty of the creation.
And that was Father Jose Funes, the director of the Vatican Observatory. Italy's most romantic heroes, often depicted in art on horseback, his red shirt and blonde shock of hair blowing wildly in the wind. It was Giuseppe Garibaldi and his 1,000 red-shirted fighters who, in the mid-19th century, led the revolution that would eventually lead to the unification of Italy's many, many states into the republic it is today. Early on, Garibaldi's revolutionary ideas were influenced by Giuseppe Mazzini and his pro-unification Young Italy movement. Mazzini shared his vision of a liberal Italian republic made possible through political and social reforms. But Mazzini and Garibaldi grew apart. Both came to differ over religion and Garibaldi's attempt to conquer the papal states. Some historians say Garibaldi had become an atheist, but his great-granddaughter, Anita Garibaldi, disagrees. Anita Garibaldi takes her name from her great-grandmother, an author and political activist. Anita carries on her family's unique legacy today. She has dedicated much of her time to research into her great-grandparents' lives, such an integral part of Italian history. Well, I sat down with this extraordinary, cheerful woman for more insight into her famous ancestors. She brings her great-grandparents to life, not just as people out of the pages of a history book, but as real people. A woman named Anita and a man named Giuseppe, who enjoyed a passionate, loving relationship and a tumultuous life.
E per la patria mia parto domani.
I think people don't understand often their relationship, as you refer to this. My great-grandfather was famous for getting to know young ladies and quickly forgetting them. and Anita wasn't like that, because not only they found a union, a physical union, which was very good, but they found objectives in life and ideals which were very, very near to each other, very similar. Anita was a young revolutionary girl in the southern part of Brazil, which was trying to emancipate itself from the imperial sort of domination, which really exploited the land and exploited the poor in a very terrible way. And her uncle was already part of the guerrilleros, which was trying to bring this about. So she grew up with all these wonderful ideas of defending the poor and getting freedom to the people who were oppressed. And when they met, they suddenly found, you see, that they wanted to do the same things. And I think this is a very strong bond. It's the kind of relationship that we would all like to find in life, I think.
Well, reading a little bit about Giuseppe Garibaldi, in 1835 he was a merchant seaman and failed revolutionary at that time. He was in exile in South America, where he enrolled in the service of Rio Grande. Rio Grande has recently broken away from the Imperial Brazil and declared itself an independent republic. And when the neighboring province of Santa Catarina decides to join the rebels, Garibaldi is sent to Laguna, the capital and principal port, as naval commander of the liberation forces. And there in 1839, he meets Anita. And this is what he wrote, apparently, about her. In 1839, he said, "Standing on deck, I happened to look towards the barra and noticed through my spyglass a young woman. I straightaway commanded a boat to take me ashore, but by the time I arrived, the woman had gone. Then a man I knew invited me home to take coffee. We entered his house, and the first person I set eyes on was the very woman I had come ashore to find." So she really made a very big impression on him. So what happened after that first encounter?
Well, she was a young woman who had grown up in this very poor fishing village in called Laguna, and had been married at 14 with a young boy of the, you know, of the town, who went away almost immediately after the marriage because the revolution had broken up and he was in the reserve service of the Imperials. So he went away and never came back again. Of course, at that time, you see, the armies of South America had somebody called a degollador, which was a chap with a long knife who just cut the throat of all the prisoners. And they didn't give death certificates, obviously. Even the parish priest thought that this had been the end of the poor man, this Manuel. So later on gave permission for them to get married about 4 years later, because she was about 18 when they married. And the impact that he made on her was very, very strong, but it was the same for him, because my grandmother, who actually spoke to him, you know, my grandmother lived 2 years before he died with Garibaldi in Caprera, and he always told her that she'd actually noticed him the day before in the church where they'd gone for the Te Deum, for thanking God for the end of the revolution, the entry in Laguna. And suddenly he met this man and he thought he was just like a young god.
Because he was handsome, flowing blonde hair.
The hair, and gold, you know, gold hair and everything.
Which must have stood out there in South America.
So she actually was completely taken aback. So it was really sudden, and it was on both sides, this wonderful attraction, which only finished when she died 10 years later.
She followed him everywhere, on all of his campaigns, is that right?
And 3 revolutions and nearly 5 children.
My goodness. And and I believe that she was pregnant also towards the end there, and
yes.
Was very sick with malaria.
No, it wasn't malaria. Actually, they were running away from Rome, and with the heat and the stress of walking across the Apennines in July, the child died. Mm-hmm. But she didn't miscarry. So she got septicemia.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's how she died.
Let's take a step back for a moment. Now, let's go through your family tree.
Yes.
You had Giuseppe and Anita Garibaldi,
yes,
who are your great-grandparents. Now, then we have Ricciotti Garibaldi, who's your grandfather, and Constance Hopcraft.
Yes.
Now, she was English.
She was English. And but Garibaldi never married Italians.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that I didn't know.
No. I did not.
So really a very international family. And then they had a child named Ezio, who was your father.
Yes.
Who in turn married Hope McMichael.
An American.
An American from Philadelphia.
Yes.
And then you yourself have children, and they're living all over the world.
And I married an Englishman.
And you married an Englishman. Quite an international family. But what was it like for you growing up with such a famous name?
It was very difficult.
Did you feel like you were living in the shadow of your family?
Well, I still do. You know, I get a reaction on from people which don't really depend on me. They'll say things which are very thoughtless at times, you know, but I can understand. But they say, for example, I'm so happy to give my hand to the great-grandchild of Garibaldi. And I keep on thinking, well, they don't want to say anything to me.
That's right. I'm somebody too. And you are quite an accomplished lady. You have many interests, and you've written books.
It's nothing compared with him. I understand, you know, because they want to actually get a feeling of touching this man, which in Italy is a myth. Mm-hmm. A myth because he was generous and he was brave, but he was also completely disinterested. And I think he actually had these wonderful values, you know, that we all like to have, the way of looking at life, but of course it's very difficult to have. Mm-hmm. This way of looking at life, you know, giving your life to the service of people is a very heavy thing to carry. Mm-hmm. And his grandchildren even were not given professions. They were just told to go and fight for the freedom of people. And it's not easy to live that way.
You feel like you're carrying that burden, let's say.
Well, no, not quite like that. Mm-hmm. I was lucky because I was able to study and I was able to, you know, I didn't have a career because I had five children. But when they grew up, I started taking another degree and I started working then. Mm-hmm. I had books and I had an education, but it wasn't just going to war to defend others.
Well, in fact, Garibaldi was known as the sword, whereas Cavour was known perhaps as the brain behind Italian unification.
Yes, yes.
But you have written books and you have also formed a political entity called Mille Donne per l'Italia, 1,000 women for Italy.
Yes.
So you, in your own way, you're carrying on this fight for perhaps the underdog, for the. The oppressed, if women can be called the oppressed today.
When I took part in politics, I really was, because I felt very, very deeply that I wanted to give voice to people that couldn't defend themselves. You know, I wanted to pass on these wonderful things that I had, because I had an education, I had means of moving around the world, and so many people haven't. And this was really why I found myself against the whole of the political system in Italy, because politicians here don't think that way.
Now, getting back to Giuseppe Garibaldi, he was born in Nice in 1807 when the city was controlled by France, to Domenico Garibaldi and Rosa Raimondi.
You're very well documented.
Oh, I studied before
you
that. And their family was in the coastal trade at the time. He became a sailor in the Mediterranean Sea and was certified merchant captain in 1832. So I have done some research. During a journey in the Black Sea, he was initiated into the Italian national movement. In 1833, he ventured to Marseille, where he met Mazzini, Giuseppe Mazzini, and enrolled in his Giovane Italia, or Young Italy movement. And Mazzini had a really profound impact on Garibaldi, who actually called him the master of the unification of Italy. But that was just the beginning. So if you had to describe your great-grandfather's role in Italian history, how would you describe it?
Well, I think he was really the person that actually managed to unify Italy. I think the unification period would have taken very, very much longer and would have been much more sort of bloody if he hadn't done it that way. If you think,
he really had a whirlwind campaign that took him all across the country.
Well,
Sicily, Naples.
Not quite. It took him up to Naples. Mm-hmm. In that period, you know, in the first period.
Right, but he was also up in Piedmont and...
Yes, that were other battles which mm-hmm. were connected more with the movements, the war movements of the King of Piedmont. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to follow orders, which for him were very difficult. It was very difficult because he had the experience, a real experience of war. And Mazzini, for example, did not. And this is why, at the beginning, when he was young, he took inspiration from his ideas and accepted his ideas. And later on, they were not very friendly. But Mazzini did some very, very harsh things against Garibaldi. But when he died, Garibaldi said, well, a great man has died and I want that the flag of the thousand be on his coffin. Because he wasn't able to have rancor, you know, to have bad feelings against people. No, it wasn't that way.
It was a very colourful, your great-grandfather was very colourful. Red is especially the colour, I think, associated with him.
You know why?
Why?
Because in Montevideo, there was a siege, and they wanted to have some shirts for the newly formed legions, Roman legion, Italian legion there, to defend the city. And there were only butcher's cloths left in the magazine because
the big warehouses.
The warehouses of the port. Mm-hmm. There was no way of getting any other cloth in because it was the city was surrounded. So they used that. And that was red, obviously.
And then he brought them over with his.
And then they started having these red shirts. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's his soldiers back in the Risorgimento were known for wearing these red shirts of Garibaldi. Now, how do you explain, let's say, for your great-grandfather's desire to capture the Papal States back then during the
unification? Oh, no, well, I really think this is a big misunderstanding because what he wanted was to have Rome as the capital of Italy. And, of course, Italy was divided up in 7 or 8 little states then, and the Papal States were one of them. So that's why he put himself against the Papal States. But in reality, at one stage earlier, he put his sword at the service of the Pope, and he thought that he might help with this process, you see. And he was very Christian. He baptized his children and married in church, and we all had very strong religious principles right through our family.
And also your own children, you said you've tried to instill in them very
Christian
values.
The same kind of
values.
Principle. You see, we just carried it like a normal thing in our family. And this is why I founded this movement to ladies and women, because I want women to bring back these traditional ideas in society. I think it's very important. And the women really carry these things, you know, from one generation to the other. Only Italian women tended to do it only in the family, not outside. And I think now the time has come to do it at large as well.
Author Anita Garibaldi, the great-granddaughter of Italy's great revolutionary hero, Giuseppe Garibaldi. That brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.